the word back at home was like, oh my gosh, she's going to make finals. And I was like, well, that was probably as best as I can do this season. Like, my husband and I were training lead in Czech Republic, and he actually decked me. So I fell to the ground. This past year, we weren't able to send a coach out to the IFSC events with our athletes due to lack of funding. I'm one of the more competitive competitors out there. We were engaged, quote unquote, for 2 weeks, and then we got married, and then we've been married ever since.
Welcome to another episode of the That's Not World Climbing podcast. I'm your host, Ginny, and I'm excited to introduce my guest, Madison Richardson. Madison is a boulder for Team Canada, and you may have seen her YouTube videos with her husband, Zach, on their channel, Richardson's Climbing. In this episode, we'll learn about the issues the Canadian climbing team faces, such as not having a head coach, her lose streak when it comes to Canadian nationals, YouTube, and deleting social media, and we'll get her take on getting married young and relationships among climbers. I really appreciated her honesty when it comes to having such a unique competitive mindset, so I really hope you enjoy this episode with Madison. Are you like training for any competitions coming up, or do you have any plans for the upcoming few weeks or months?
Yeah, well, because of the Olympics, there's a bit of a gap. I'm only doing the World Cup, like the bouldering season this year. I'm a boulder specialist. So I didn't go for the Olympics this past cycle. So I have like a really spaced out season this year. So yeah, all of August is completely free. And then we're training for the like Prague and Seoul World Cups at the end of the year.
Oh, is Prague also bouldering?
Yeah. Prague and Seoul. I think one of them is like speed as well. I think it's Seoul has speed.
I guess it kind of threw me off that they were even having bouldering at the end of the season this year. So
no, yeah, I'm super thrown off too.
Yeah, it'll be exciting to watch. Is it like different for you, like having to train for, I guess, the first few World Cups and then you have a long break and then doing it again?
Yeah, it's honestly, it's a little bit difficult, like mentally, just to be just on all season. Usually the season is like April to June, and it's a really short, really quick, like super travel intensive couple months. But this year, it's like you go to World Cup and you come home for a month, you go to another World Cup. And so having to like think about performance all year, basically from April to October, is pretty crazy. And I'm definitely ready for it to be done. I would have liked to be done like 2 months ago. It's honestly really hard to maintain. Like, you're thinking about not getting injured, and like, I'm not getting better at climbing. I'm just kind of staying level. It's kind of just mentally, I'm like ready to start like improving for next season, but I have to finish this season. So it's difficult.
So did this like August time, well, and also like most of July too, did that not really feel like a break or like a training season?
Yeah, it's, I mean, I had a bit of a heavier workload on in July, just because we had 2 months to prepare for, or 2.5, almost 3 months to prepare between Innsbruck and Prague. Innsbruck was like end of June and Prague is like end of September. So there was a good couple months there to get some actual training in, opposed to just kind of really low volume stuff that I usually do. So yeah, July was pretty intense on like working out, but it's still nowhere near the intensity I have like coming right into like an off season. So it definitely doesn't feel the same.
Yeah. I find it really interesting as like a non-athlete, basically, that the competition season, I guess I've heard it's kind of like you're just getting worse at climbing as the competition season goes on. Yeah, what's that like? Because I think a lot of people just like don't realize that's what happens.
No, yeah, absolutely. It was actually interesting. The first World Cup of the season was like my like career best result. It was like seventh place, and I was like really psyched. But like seventh is like kind of close to finals. So like the word back at home was like, oh my gosh, she's going to make finals. And I was like, well, that was probably as best as I can do this season. Like the first one is like you're ready, you're trained up, you're like your mind is fresh, you're like motivated, you go and do it. And then, you know, you have a month off and then, okay, another one, let's try again. Okay, another month. And yeah, it does go down. So the expectation was really high, like just in terms of my like community around me. and myself, I guess, but it's definitely really hard to top the earlier season results.
Interesting. I mean, I guess you would think that everyone else would also be dealing with that same issue. So in that way, is it kind of just like who's better at maintaining this state of awfulness, like as long as they can?
Yeah, I mean, this season was a bit of like an outlier. I'm sure it'll be kind of like this going forward now that the Olympics is a thing. But not everyone was training for the same thing all season. Like I was just going for the circuit. So every World Cup cert, like World Cup was like my priority, whereas other people were trying to like peak in, you know, the towards July and August for the Olympics. And some people were skipping World Cups and like trying to peak all over the place. And I was just trying to like peak and then stay there. And I guess there were a couple people in my boat, but I feel like a lot of people were going for the OQS Olympic series. So I was a little bit alone. There weren't many people doing exactly what I was doing. But I'm just so not into lead that I just couldn't bring myself to do it.
Okay, gotcha. I actually had a question about lead. Well, I'll get into it after. So yeah, in general, how did you get into climbing and competing?
Yeah, it's probably a similar story to most people. You know, you have a local climbing gym and then there's like a kids program. You get into that. For me, it was my stepdad was the first person in the family to get into climbing. And he dragged, you know, the stepchildren out and the, you know, the whole family. Once he gets into something, he just like really gets into it. So he brings everyone down with him trying to like get them into his hobbies. So it took me actually quite a few months to get to the gym. I was not interested in it at all. I mostly didn't like the idea of being like pretty bad at something compared to him. I was only 10 at the time, but I really liked being in my comfort zone and things that like, I'm used to. So he brought me out and I actually happened to be like fairly decent at it, you know, off the bat. You know, I joined a local like climbing club. It wasn't the youth team. It wasn't the comp team. It was like a step below that. It was like a feeder youth program that goes into the competition team, which I think is a perfect way to get someone into the comp scene because it is quite intimidating to go from like a hobby to now you're competing at this,
sure.
I feel like oftentimes people are being pushed, like kids are being pushed to kind of go compete, which I would definitely push kids to compete, but like definitely not right away. It's pretty intimidating. It can often like kind of do the opposite for your motivation and love for the sport. So it was a nice, slow, like transition into competitions. I think it took me like 3 or 4 years to start competing.
Sounds good. And you only do boulder then?
Yeah, I used to do lead a lot. I can't believe like some, when I think about my memories with lead, I can't, like, I know that I used to love it. I know it used to be like, really? People would ask me like, which discipline do you like more? I'm like, well, whatever season it is the discipline I like more. Like in Ontario, we do bouldering for like 2 months and then we do a lead season. And then we have like a, you know, a combined cup or whatever it was back then. So it would always be a very harsh transition between boulder and lead. You'd do boulder for like 2 months and then completely stop bouldering and then just focus on lead. And I was fairly decent at it. I did make the youth national team 1 year. I came in like third at nationals and went to China, I think was my youth world there. And just a couple years in, I just started to lose my passion for it a little bit. Endurance. I've just never been an endurance kind of person. I don't go for runs. When I was in gym class, you know, I would always dread the laps or whatever that kind of endurance focused thing was. I'm sure many people can relate with that, but, I was definitely drawn towards the really quick, like powerful side of bouldering. And I remember there was my last youth nationals in lead. I remember I made finals like by the skin of my teeth. And I looked up at the final boulder right before I was about to do it. And the thought in my head was like, I don't want to do this. That looks really tiring. This does not look like a good time. I'm not excited to do this final.
And, like final lead route?
Yeah, like the final route in the competition. So yeah, that was just like a very clear, like that can't be my mindset if I'm trying to do like compete. Like I can't be dreading what I'm about to do. So that was like a clear sign I need to probably stop doing lead and focus on what I'm actually still enjoying, which was bouldering.
Yeah. So looking at the past competitions you've been to on the IFSU page. I saw that it was mostly Boulder, but I think you actually did do one lead competition in the senior circuit. What was the reason for that one?
So I did actually, when the Olympics got announced for climbing, for 2024, when it was lead and Boulder combined, I did make the decision to start training for it. And I hadn't done lead in probably 3 or 4 years. So I was definitely, you know, doing a Hail Mary, trying to push for it, see if my lead could even like stack up on the world circuit. At that time, my bouldering was pretty good. I had made finally a semi in bouldering at the World Cup. So I was like, okay, maybe I could do it. You know, it'd be really cool if, you know, if there's even a shot that I could make the Olympics, I might as well go for it. So I spent 2 years training for lead. And of course, I had to qualify for lead World Cups with the national team in order to even like have a shot at doing lead in the OQS. So I made the lead team. At the time, it was like a combined thing. So my boulder score actually happened to be good enough that even though I had not very good lead scores, because it was a combined ranking, I was able to actually make the combined team. So I did qualify for some lead World Cups. I actually qualified for 3 lead World Cups. But a week before, I think it was the Edinburgh Lead World Cup, my husband and I were training lead in Czech Republic, and he actually decked me. So I fell to the ground. And so it was only from second clip, so it wasn't so bad. But it was one of those like cement, it was just a complete cement floor with like a thin carpet. And I basically essentially just jumped from the second clip down, landed flat on my feet. Didn't roll my ankle or anything, but I fell so hard that it bruised my bone on my heel. Oh. So it was kind of stressful. I had to go to like a hospital in like the Czech Republic and then all this sort of stuff. But long story short, I couldn't compete in 2 lead World Cups because I had to completely not weight my heel. And then the only lead World Cup I was able to do was the last one of the season in Jakarta. So I had to go all the way to Indonesia in order to qualify for future World Cups. And it was my first lead World Cup. It was like I was literally not planning on doing that one. I was going to just stick to the 2 European ones, but yeah, because I was injured, I had to do Jakarta. And, I clipped one of them on the first route. Like I clipped the third clip before I clipped the second clip. So I got disqualified on that route. And then the other route, I just didn't do well enough at. So it was quite the disastrous lead season for me. And then I, at that point, I was like, okay, this is just not happening. My performance wasn't there. And then I didn't have enough, you know, experience in World Cup. So that was my sole lead adventure. But I am glad, actually, I had the experience of doing a lead World Cup in the IFSC, because it is extremely, it's terrifying. It's so, like, nerve-wracking, like, I did not enjoy the process. Like I thought I wouldn't. Like I thought maybe it would be okay, but no. That lead World Cups in the IFSC are just like the hardest thing you can do. So I definitely look up to them.
Yeah, terrifying because of the route or because of the crowd or.
Well, it's like just pressure? Well, with lead you get like one shot. So when you step up, you're like, okay, let's climb as tense as possible and as statically as possible to not fall, and it just makes for a very bad performance, I find.
I've always wondered about that because I feel like that's so much pressure to not be able to mess up at all.
Oh, yes. Like this is probably like 50% of the reason I don't do lead anymore. Like I like having the security knowing you can try again. And that almost lets me perform better in bouldering because I'm more free to do the dynamic moves.
Yeah, that makes sense. When you decked, did you get injured? Like did you shatter your heel or...
Yeah, so we had to get an X-ray to make sure it wasn't a broken heel, and I guess with a bone bruise, you technically are like breaking the bone, but not enough. Like it's just like small. It was almost like it was like porous. Like if you look at the X-ray, it wasn't like all black or all white, whatever it's supposed to be. It had like a little bit of like a different color at the bottom. So it's like. It's like you're about to break the bone. Like if you landed like that again, it would just be a complete shatter. You know, it's like, this is like the last and final warning if you're going to do anything on your heel. So you can't take the risk of putting any weight on it after that.
Interesting. Okay. So did that have any effect on your like mental side when it came to lead. I've never like decked, so I don't really know what that would feel like.
Yeah, I mean, there's feather decking, which is when you like fall, but you kind of just graze the floor, which I have done before in a gym setting with really thick mats. So it's like, that's not very scary. But my husband actually is boulder only as well. So when I started training lead, he actually learned how to lead belay. He had been climbing for like 10 years, but he'd never learned how to belay.
Oh, wow.
So, okay. Yeah. So he was fairly inexperienced, and he definitely, it was the classic, like a lot of slack waiting for me to like clip. So he just put it all out, but I hadn't even motioned to clip yet. And then I got into a position, but then I slipped and then I fell and all the slack was just there. It was no time to bring it in. So his lack of experience, I think, was like the biggest issue. But since then, he's gotten a lot better. And I trust him quite a bit more now. And he learned a lot from that mistake. Yeah. The moral of the story is trust your belay partner, and not just as a person, but like trust the ability. Like I trusted him, but I did not maybe necessarily trust his experience level in belaying.
Yeah. Okay. So any interest in training lead climbing in the future, or are you done forever?
Honestly, I didn't mind the training. Like it's actually kind of interesting. It was a good change of pace. And I do still train endurance as a boulderer. You do need a little bit of it. So if my coach happens to put in like lead training as endurance, I am all for that, actually. But that said, it's been probably a year now since my husband has belayed. So we'd probably have to do a quick refresher if we were to jump back into it.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay. So then what does your training look like nowadays?
So I do have a coach. His name is Libor Hroza. People probably don't remember who he is. He was a speed world champion back in the day. He's from the Czech team and he lives in Canada now. He's a Canadian citizen and he's been involved with the Canadian team for a while. I met him actually through the Canadian team. He was hired as our new like head coach. And at the time he was overseeing all three disciplines. Today, he's just a speed coach, so he's not technically my national team coach, but he is just my personal coach now. So I kind of stole him and just took him for myself when he was hired. And I just asked if he could do any, because I was looking for a coach at the time, and the CEC said, here's a qualified coach. And I said, can you do a little more for me? Because I'm looking for some actual coaching. So he does actually live across the country. He lives in BC, which is the West Coast, and I'm in Montreal, which is like the far East Coast. We couldn't be further away.
Yeah.
So he does remote coaching for me. We've been doing it since 2021, and he's really great at programming. He just knows exactly what level to push me at, like where the cap is for like what I'm able to do, and he just like threads the line like so perfectly. It's a lot of endurance, I'd say, like when it comes to the off season, like fitness is like the whole goal. You basically don't climb as much as you do off the wall training and conditioning, which is great. That's totally my mindset. I think I've deprioritized climbing a lot in my training. Just over the years, I've kind of tried to build like a good base of strength and conditioning. And then I kind of flip to the performance side during certain times of the year, or kind of in certain years of my whole climbing career. It's kind of a long-term approach that I've had to it. Just since I was a kid, the first thing was like, you got to get strong. So at the expense of my like climbing and technique development, I just got really strong. And then I was able to flip the switch and do more of the technique side with already a good base of strength. So my coach Libor really has the same kind of philosophy. So yeah, off season is all about getting strong. And then on season / maybe like 2-3 months out, it's all about like climbing. So we almost do like, you know, 20 to 80 in the on season of off the wall conditioning to climbing.
I wonder if that's something I should try. I've never tried like just getting strong and like not climbing at all, but interesting. I think I would hate that though. I don't know if I could handle doing that.
I was going to say, this is kind of like the like pro athlete side of it. It's like taking the bit of the fun out of it in exchange for a little bit of performance enhancement.
I mean, if it would work, I would consider it.
Yeah, I mean, I probably will. Yeah.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this. Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Interesting. Okay. And so you and your husband, Zach, have been moving around a little bit. You lived in Germany last year, and now you're both back in Canada, in Montreal. What was the purpose of both of these moves?
Yeah. So we were from the Toronto area. He's from Burlington. I'm from like KW Kitchener. So they're fairly smaller areas. And in Ontario, the climbing scene is pretty... I don't want to say bad. It's a little bit underdeveloped, let's say that. The gyms are pretty spaced out, like few and far between. If you want to kind of go to a couple different gyms in a day, it's going to be quite the trek, and you'll have to have a car probably. In denser cities like Montreal, for example, it's like all the gyms are really close to each other. So it does get it's a lot easier to get the volume in, the exposure to different kind of moves, which is pretty essential. So back in Ontario, we were really struggling to get the get different moves in our diet. And we were seeing just kind of the same boulders day to day. There's not a lot of emphasis on competition climbing in Ontario either. And we find that it just seems like when you're just looking at the, you know, on social media or you're looking wherever you're looking, it seems like other areas just have it more together. It seems like they know what they're doing. You know, they have a nice community of competition climbing, and we just never had that growing up. So around the time that I stopped doing lead climbing, when I stopped pushing for it, we made the decision to move to Germany. And we picked Germany because, first of all, there was a one-year visa that was only available to, I think it's like 30-year-olds and under. It's like a youth mobility visa.
Oh, interesting.
So you can only use it, you can only apply for it once. And so, you know, now's the time. We're young, you know, we're able to do this. We were living with our family, so we had a lot of like family support. And so we made the big, bold move to move to Frankfurt. And Frankfurt is where we've got like Studio Block, which is the gym that hosts Studio Block Masters. And it's an awesome gym. It's probably one of our favorite gyms. We'd been there a couple times before. And it's just a playground of bouldering, and it's very competition focused, and it's a great community there. There's a couple other gyms in the area as well, but just being in Europe in general is just such a great place to be for climbing. It's like it's probably 10 years ahead of Canada. So that was a great move. We stayed there for I think it was 10 months in total. I happened to speak German as well, so that was a little bit of the draw.
From what, like, do you have German family or?
Yeah, my dad's side of the family is German, and not fully, like, he's not a German citizen, but I think his parents were, and, you know, the generations before that. So I went to German school as a kid, and I've always, like, you know, going to German school, you're like, what am I doing this for? I live in Canada. Like, so my dream was always to go and use it in Germany. So when we had the opportunity, we're like, okay, it's a good climbing community in Germany. Should we move there? I was like, I really want to do this. That sounds like a great time. So I had a great time in Germany. I think my husband was a little bit more kind of fish out of water, didn't speak the language. So he was kind of relying on me. And it's just hard to feel like a tourist every day when you're in a different country. Like some countries are better than others. Of course, Germany, there's lots of English spoken, but it's definitely nowhere near being in your own country or being in the States, for example.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. So towards the end, we were starting to get a little bit like, okay, you know, this was cool. The climbing was great. But it's probably time to move home. There were a couple options in the air. We could have gone to Britain. We could have gone somewhere else. But we're like, you know what? We've never actually tried Montreal. As when we were living in Ontario, we would make monthly trips to Montreal because Montreal's gyms are just amazing. And there's so many of them, very competition focused. It's certainly one of the best cities, I think, in the world for climbing. And it happens to be, you know, 6-hour drive from our house. So when we were done with Germany and we moved back to Canada, the next step was to just move to Montreal, we thought. So 3 months ago, we moved to Montreal, and that is where we are now. And we have absolutely no regrets. I'll say in Montreal, they do speak French, which is we don't speak French.
Okay.
If you grew up anywhere outside of Quebec in Canada, you don't really know French unless you take like French immersion in school. But the normal public school education, they give you a bit of French, but not nearly enough to be proficient at it. And once you hit high school, you can now drop French completely if you want to, which I did. So yeah, French is pretty bad, but it's quite Anglophone in Montreal. I've heard that it's a little bit less, there's a little bit less English outside of Montreal, but we're just going to stay in Montreal. So I think we'll be fine. We'll probably have to learn a bit of French, but it's definitely like a slight barrier when it comes to living here, despite being Canada.
Oh, I didn't know it was like so much more French than English. Like French is the default?
Mm-hmm. It's actually, Quebec actually is the only province in Canada that has French as its only official language. The English isn't even an official language in Quebec.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I thought it was more English and then just like a bit more French than most people are used to.
No, like all the signs, like the road signs are all in French. Like sometimes we'll be driving on the highway and there'll be like a sign and we'll be like, I hope that's not something important because I have no idea what that says. So yeah, it's a little bit, I'm not going to lie, it's a little bit frustrating because it's like we didn't learn the French. Like we just can't. And it's hard to like have a whole province that you're just a little bit less almost welcome in. But I think they're very like they were colonized by France is like the Quebec thing. And the rest of Canada was colonized by Britain. So they do try to keep those kind of French roots, which I do respect. It just makes it hard. And I now have to learn another language to live in my own country, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, geez, that's rough. But yeah, so let's get into Canada climbing in general. You're the first Canadian climber I've had on. I think in general, people don't know that much about climbing in Canada since I guess the biggest stars have not come from Canada recently.
Right.
So there's just not that much info out there. For now, I think you mentioned that you were on the Athletes Commission for the Climbing Escalade Canada.
Yeah, I'm working on it. Yeah, not quite.
Okay. Do you know like any like some of the issues that
the CEC?
Yeah, the CEC. Any of like the issues that they're working on at the moment?
Yeah, I think for the past probably ever, like forever, we've just been working on funding. I think that's our biggest thing. We try to optimize as much as we can with our funding constraints. But I think that's just the elephant in the room with any topic we ever have to talk about. This past year, we weren't able to send a coach out to the IFSC events with our athletes due to lack of funding. And I think potentially lack of we didn't maybe find an applicant. I'm not sure if that's the case, but I know it was definitely funding related. And we don't pay our athletes. We don't cover accommodation costs or flights. And it's that's just been the status quo forever. And it's hard to talk to other countries knowing that they're, you know, getting paid to go to the World Cups. And I just feel like that's the dream when in reality, for a lot of countries, it's like the status quo. So it's definitely a bit of an uphill battle when it comes to climbing in Canada. It's just so underdeveloped. And we don't have a Canadian shoe brand. We don't have as many Canadian based brands that are in the climbing scene other than Arc'teryx. But yeah, it's a definite struggle. As the athletes, I think we feel it the most, but I'm sure the CEC would say that like the Climbing Escalade Canada would say that, you know, it's hard just for everyone. It's hard to like pay people to do the jobs in order to get more funding. It's just kind of an endless cycle. And I feel like the answer is always funding, funding, funding. And it's just so hard to get it.
So you mentioned that you guys don't have a coach this year. Is this just for the team in general?
Yeah. We had a coach last year, but I think he resigned towards the end of the year. And then we just didn't get a new one this year. It was kind of announced at the beginning of the season that we're not going to be sending a team or a coach to any of the World Cups, apart from the OQS events. We were able to send one guy out there. He wasn't actually an official coach. He went to the Pan Ams last year And that was his first event. And then he went straight to OQS. So he's only done Pan Ams and the two OQS events, the biggest ones.
Yeah. That must be stressful for the coach as well.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, he's a great guy too. He's like a climbing coach. Like, it's not like he doesn't know how to coach. And it would be great if he was the like national coach. I don't think we have any plans kind of in store for that. But yeah, it was announced. I remember I was selected to go to the China World Cup, and then they said, okay, there's also no coach. And I accepted it. And then they told us that. And I was like kind of second guessing it a little bit, because it was, you know, I haven't been to China in like 5 years. And I was actually the oldest person going to China. Like, all the other teammates were a year or two younger than me. So I felt like I was kind of the person in charge, and I didn't feel very competent at all going to China. So it was a little bit stressful. I had to do a lot of research and really kind of rely on myself to get around. And, you know, it was quite the responsibility. And luckily we had the US national team coach help us out in China. He grabbed our bibs. He told us whatever from the technical meeting. He like set me a boulder in the semi isolation zone. So that was great. He was great. But then I guess as the season went on, I think he was focusing on OQS, and then we kind of lost our US coach help. And so, some athletes stepped up and started going to the technical meetings for the team. We had one athlete that was injured that was just showing up to support his brother. It was Victor Bodrand. And he went to the technical meetings for us, and he would like text us updates and all that sort of stuff. So he was amazing. But it is kind of it's almost like unifying us as a team, because we kind of have to step up for ourselves and support each other a little bit more than when we had a coach. So I actually don't really mind it. But at the same time, it can be stressful when there's actually like important appeals to be done or things to really navigate. But when it's like smooth sailing, it's not so bad.
Okay. Yeah. I guess I didn't realize like what kind of roles the coach takes on. Like, when I think about a coach, I just think like, oh, someone who helps you with training, or someone who helps you with your technique, or things like that, rather than all of the little logistical things that it sounds like a coach was working through for the Canadian team.
Yeah, I'd say probably don't take the Canadian team definition of a coach as like the general coach role in teams. I don't have a great understanding of what other teams are doing. I know the US coach a little bit better, and I know he's a bit more involved in like the actual training part. But for us in the Canadian team, like as long as I've been on the team, our coach position has really just been, he would run kind of training camps in Canada, and that would be all we'd see of him other than the World Cups. And then we wouldn't get any programming specifically from the coach. It would be kind of personal coaches or our own own coaching of ourselves. But yeah, it is more of like an administrative task when it comes to World Cups, like going to the technical meeting, getting the bibs, hearing the rules, asking questions, and then at the actual event, like just going into ISO with us, making sure we know where we're going, checking the running order kind of list, and then going out, watching us climb, noting down our scores so that in case there's an appeal, he or she can go and file that with the IFSC.
So then does the Canada team train together much at all? You like maybe have some training camps, but not that much.
Yeah. Well, so our funding has kind of taken a dip in the last couple of years. So we used to do lots of training camps. Probably, I think we did like twice or three times in a year. We'd have our selection event, and then we'd have a training camp or two throughout the season. In the past, we've also had training camps between World Cups in certain countries, because we're all just kind of, if it's the same kind of group of people going from one World Cup to the other, and then there's like a week between, we'll just throw a training camp in there. So we've definitely done it a lot more than we've done it this past year, because we've been we just haven't had the funding for it. And the World Cups have also been really spaced out. So the in-between World Cup training camps are like non-existent. Even if we had the funding for it, it's just like no one's sticking around after a World Cup. We just go home because it's expensive to have accommodation costs, but they're also just so far apart that it's not feasible. But yeah, Canada is a really, really big country, and the States is too, but I think the difference is the National Training Center. We don't really have one gym or one city that we kind of call athletes to. Montreal is obviously, I think, one of the best gym cities in Canada. and some people just naturally live here. But Zach and I, my husband, have been the only ones to really make the move to Montreal for training. There's been no other national team athletes that have done that. There's been one, Victor Baudrand, who moved from Salt Lake City to Montreal a couple of years ago for school and for climbing, I'm assuming. But yeah, it's really hard to get together with national team athletes, especially when they live in BC, and like the cost to go from like you have to take a whole flight to get over to train with them. So unless the CEC could fund us more to come together for a training camp, it's really not in the cards unless they live in the same city as you.
Yeah, because BC would be like the other place where there's a lot of climbers, right? Like that's where the outdoor climbing is as well, like Squamish.
Exactly.
And stuff.
Yeah, so that's where Sean and Lana lived and competed and trained. And then the McNamee twins are there as well. And we have Becca Frangos out west. Like there's a whole bunch of people out there. And then it feels like you're either in BC or you're in either Ontario or Quebec. So every once in a while, some athletes from Ontario will drive up to Montreal, but it won't be for more than a weekend. And oftentimes, just because we've never really hung out together, we don't really know each other that well either. So oftentimes they'll come up, but they'll just kind of do their own thing. Or we happen to run into them in the gym. We don't really climb together anyway. So it's really tough. We're starting to make friends, I think, in Montreal, just me and Zach specifically. Which I've never really made friends in the past on the national team just because of the geography and just naturally it just hasn't really happened. But when you just live in the same area as someone for a couple months, you just start to see them more often, then you get to know them more, and it just happens naturally. And I think in the past the CEC has tried to almost like force it a little bit, not in like an aggressive way, but more like, hey, we're going to host like a friendship camp, and they'll call it friendship camp, and then they'll say, okay, make friends. And we just feel like, this isn't really how friendship works. Like you kind of need to like go about it naturally. So I think for us, I've now finally realized what natural national team friendships are like. And it's really awesome. But it's hard to get everyone on board when we don't see each other enough.
Yeah, I think proximity is like one of the main drivers of friendship, just for sure. In general. Yeah, it's a shame that there's just so much like nothingness in between in Canada, I guess.
Yeah, there's actually, so we've got 13 provinces and territories in total, and I think only like 8 or 7 of them are actually registered provinces with the CEC. So like Saskatchewan, for example, I'm pretty sure Saskatchewan is one of the ones in between. I think there's Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba are all between Ontario and BC. And Alberta is definitely a big player in the CEC, but the Manitoba and Saskatchewan are very few athletes there, and it's a huge amount of area. So like you got to really jump all the way over those two provinces if you want to go connect with some other athletes.
Yeah, that definitely makes it rough. So makes a lot of sense. So one of the Discord questions that came in, I think, kind of fit in here. They asked, with Alana and Sean retiring this season, what obstacles will the new generation of Canadian athletes need to overcome to outperform their precursors?
Yeah, so I've actually thought about this a little bit. I find I'm pretty competitive with Alana. I think towards the end of her career, when she was still competing in the IFSC World Cups, I was starting to be a little neck and neck with her. And then there was a point where I was like, oh my gosh, I'm starting to like outperform her. And it was like the craziest thing, considering all the semis she's made, the final and the Olympics. Like it's just a crazy kind of torch to try to hold. And I think climbing in general is also changing a lot. And back in the day, it was, I think we saw a lot more consistency in our semifinalists and finalists. That's how we kind of created like almost like the old guard, which like you kind of would be able to predict who's in like almost every final and every semifinal. And so Sean and Lana were like in a lot of the finals and semis. And as their careers went on, of course, they got stronger as well. They kept making semis, but it would be a little like more few and far between because of the dynamic nature of boulders and the low percentage moves and all that sort of new school moves are really shaking it up a little bit. And so it's almost like I almost try to now think of it like I'm not directly comparing one-to-one with Alana, for example, anymore, because it is such, it's not a different sport, but it's pretty, pretty different. If we're comparing 2014 to 2024, it's a huge difference. And so for that reason, I try to not to like compare my results exactly to hers. And, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm like, okay, well, she made this many semis. Maybe I can try to live up to that. Maybe that's a number I can try to beat, but it's just really not the exact same. So it's more just like, I just want to, you know, be like her, but not be who she was, if that makes sense.
Do you feel like comparison is a big part of competition for you? Because I know some people try to like not have comparison in the back of their mind. It like depends on their, how they like to mentally approach it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to not, you know, like, especially if you're one-to-one in a competition with someone and you're on the exact same boulders, it's like, how can you not compare everyone's performance against each other?
Please excuse this brief intermission, but I've gotten a few requests for this, so I just wanted to announce that if you're interested in helping support the show, my Patreon page is now live. Some perks include ad-free, interruption-free episodes, deleted scenes, prioritized guest questions, or the ability to submit video questions, an enamel pin shipped to you after 2 months of membership, and much more to come. The proceeds go back into the podcast to help me break even, and they help improve the experience of the guests. If you'd like to support the podcast non-monetarily, liking, commenting, and sharing helps a great deal as well. Back to the show.
And especially climbing is an individual sport. So it's like it's just you. Like even being on a national team doesn't mean quite as much as it would on like a team sport where it is a team. Like the national team in Canada is really just a bunch of Canadians competing against each other now, not in Canada, but in a different country. So yeah, you definitely compare against the Canadians more. Like I compare against the Canadians more than anyone else. There's a couple people I'm now like kind of chasing and kind of have my eye on in the World Cup circuit as someone that I think like athletes that perform similarly to me, like maybe someone I can kind of chase and be motivated by. But I find that the most difficult competition is definitely the national level because we're all kind of vying for the like fame, the support and admiration, I guess, of our country. So you kind of want to be like the country favorite, I think, is what we're all trying to go for. It's hard to just have all this stuff flying around. Like I'm trying to compete in World Cups and do my best there, but I'm also trying to like do well nationally and like keep going with the people that I've grown up with competing against. Competition, like it's good and it's bad and it just is ever present and it's hard to ignore. And I think just you kind of got to go day by day and case by case, like event by event, like trying not to let it be the negative over the positive.
So the comparison kind of fuels you in a way.
Yeah. As long as it doesn't go too far. I find like with nationals specifically, national finals, like trying to win nationals is a very difficult task. And I think it has the most pressure of any competition I go to.
Interesting.
Like World Cups are great and I've seen lots of success in World Cups, but nationals, I've never actually won nationals. And I've made finals 7 years in a row now, and I've made the podium 6 years in a row, and it's starting to be very frustrating. And like I said, like we're all kind of vying for the best in Canada, like title. And I just feel like, you know, my World Cup results aside, I feel like I've never really punched that ticket. I've never really like found that success. And I think for a lot of athletes now, it's like at the national team level, that is like a tick box you have to like check off at some point in your career. And so the pressure when it comes down to finals at nationals is humongous. And it's become kind of a competition I dread a little bit at times, especially given my history at the event. But this year it's in Montreal, which is awesome because it's a bit more comfortable, know the gym, know the community. But at the same time, it could be more pressure because, you know, my whole peer group is there and the community's there. But I don't know how I'm going to approach nationals this year. But I know my mindset has been way too hyper comparison focused and competition focused at nationals. And I need to find a way to put that aside and just focus on climbing itself.
Okay, well, best of luck to you at that nationals.
And, thank you.
Hopefully you can find maybe like one of those mental coaches. Maybe that can help you push through.
Honestly, I think that is probably the next step. Yeah.
Well, good luck to you there. So moving on to, I guess, like your social media and YouTube side of things. Well, I guess lack of social media.
Right.
You mentioned that you've been off of social media since you were 18 to focus on training. Did you have social media before then? Did you super have social media where you were on it all the time and you like found it super distracting?
Yeah, I was a super social media kind of person. It's actually the more years that go by, the more I start to forget what it really was like. I remember when I first quit, it was a big change in my life because it was all consuming. It was in my head. It was like in the training room. Like it was everywhere. So I was on social media kind of as a kid would be, you know, social media, Instagram specifically came about just as I was about, I think like 14 or 13. So it was right exactly when I should have joined it. And that's when it became a thing. So it was like all the rage, everyone joined it. So I did as well. And it was only when I started seeing some success in climbing that it started turning into a bigger thing in my life. It never used to be, it was always just, you know, chatting with friends, posting random photos that no one cares about. And then all of a sudden I was like winning youth nationals and I was like going to World Cups and it became very important to me. And it felt like it was becoming part of how to make a career in climbing. So I was on it a lot and I definitely got carried away with it. And I think I got carried away kind of not because of me. It was more because of the platform. It's just made to be addictive, I find. And as a competitor, I feel like I'm one of the more competitive competitors out there. And so just seeing other athletes, other teammates on social media doing what they're doing, you know, looking strong, they sent that boulder. I was just at that gym. I didn't send that boulder. They're sending hard outside. I don't climb outside. So it's like, I don't know if I would even like ever be able to do that kind of thing. You know, seeing their results, seeing what they're eating, like it just was way too much for me. And I only realized that probably 2 or 3 years in when I saw it was starting to kind of impact my performance and my mindset and my mental health. So when I was 18, I was doing a lot of reading about ego and, you know, philosophy and all that sort of stuff. And I realized that I think social media was kind of at the heart of some of the negativity I found in my mental state. And so it was right before one of the Open National Championships that I decided to completely get rid of the app, get rid of my account, and just leave social media permanently. And it to this day, I think it's one of the most important decisions I've made, like as a person. I did it for the training side, I think mostly. Sure, there were some pretty compelling mental health reasons behind it as well, but the benefit it had to my training immediately was just, it was unparalleled. All of a sudden, I would go to the gym and my mind would just be quiet. Like I didn't know what other people were doing. I was just like, I had my head down and I was just like focusing on myself and my training and my climbing. And when nationals rolled around, it ended up being one of the best nationals of my life. I almost beat Alana, as I said, like my lifelong competitor. And at the time, I had no business beating Alana. It was not definitely, I was not in my prime. She was definitely the best in Canada at the time, but I came very close. And it shocked me and it really motivated me. And it was, I think, largely due to my departure from social media just a few months earlier. And yeah, to this day, I am still off of Instagram. I don't have any social media platforms other than YouTube. And so, yeah, it's a pretty quiet life. My phone is very quiet. Like I don't get very many notifications. If people want to message me, they typically message my husband and they kind of speak to him as if they're speaking to me, which is a little bit strange. But I do have a phone number so that people could text me. But for whatever reason, Instagram is still the platform of choice for instant messaging.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Yeah. So yeah, there are absolutely drawbacks. Like I don't get as many messages. I don't get maybe as many opportunities for hanging out with people or going to events, whatever it happens to be. But I think I've made a pretty fair trade-off in terms of the mental health side benefits from it. So A bit of FOMO, but I think my husband, he does have a social media account. He did delete it for a while when we first started dating. I convinced him to delete it, of course. But he got it back probably a year later. And I think like I'm okay with it. I think it's good to have us kind of more out there. It is hard to make a career in Canada in climbing when you have no, you know, online presence. So he helps a lot with that. And then the YouTube, I think, does the rest of the legwork.
You mentioned that for a lot of climbers, it kind of seems like social media is partially how you fund your pro climber journey. Have you found it hurts like sponsorship prospects without having social media?
Yeah, it probably did for the first few years. Luckily, I had a couple sponsors at the time, and they didn't care that I left social media. And I think that's a good, it was almost like, it's kind of like a data point I use when I'm kind of saying this to other people, that like people are afraid of losing the sponsorship side. And, you know, of all the sponsors I've spoken to, there's a couple outliers, but most of them say like, we don't really care about the social media side. We don't care how many followers you have. It's more about who you are and what you represent and what you're doing. And of course it does help to show more people what you're doing, but I think, a lot of people have Instagram, and it's not as much of a unique thing anymore. And I think what's unique is kind of putting yourself out there in different ways. And for me, I found like a blog. I've been blogging this whole time. I've never stopped blogging since deleting social media. I've probably blogged more, to be honest. And it's more, I feel like, high quality, just more thinking goes into my blogs, more attention. And I think I'm putting out something that I really am proud of on my blog. And same with YouTube, you know, we're putting together really, you know, difficult to put together videos, and it's not quite as easy as just posting a photo. And I think there's some inherent extra value when it comes to sponsors in that. And for the first 2 years, it probably did hurt because I didn't have the YouTube, and my blog was okay, but it definitely wasn't very popular. So it wasn't until we started YouTube that the sponsorship started coming. And it was kind of when I joined forces with Zach too, when we got married, that we started to kind of have a combined, almost not celebrity status, but we had more supporters together, and we were together. We kind of almost advertised ourselves together. And so in this past year, I've seen more sponsors than I've seen in the last 5 years. And it's been without Instagram. I think our Instagram has nothing to do with it. His Instagram is not super popular. He only started it like a year ago or so. And it's more just about what we're doing and how we're involved in our Montreal community right now.
Yeah. Do you have any plans or interests of getting back on social media in the future? Maybe when you're done competing or?
Yeah, it absolutely crosses my mind. Probably like once every 6 months or so, I start thinking, okay, am I really hurting myself here? But I think the further away I get from my time on social media, the more I forget how much I didn't enjoy my headspace when I was on social media. So I have a blog post on, like an article on my blog that kind of tells my whole story about how I went from social media to deleting it. And it was actually pretty popular, got picked up by another blog, like a really big blog. And it started kind of getting like semi-viral. And it kind of really, like all the comments on the other blog, like the people who saw this article, it went pretty big. And like so many people like messaged me after saying, after reading your blog, I deleted social media. Or, you know, this really like made me think harder about what I'm doing online. It really gave me some positive reinforcement for what I was doing. So every once in a while, I'll go back and read that article because I don't want to ever forget the headspace I was in, because it is really easy to forget about it, because I've lived so long as I do now, which is like without tons of notifications on my phone. And like there'll be days where I leave the house and I forget to bring my phone because it's just not a thing in my life. It's not like an important thing. I don't even have YouTube on my phone. It's really just for texting and for checking maybe the YouTube Studio app, which is the app you use to just check all your comments and stuff on YouTube. I you know, the FOMO kind of gets you thinking maybe I should go back to it, but then I just always try to bring myself back to why I did it in the first place. And I think just long-term, not even about trading anymore, like it, like when I started, it was because of training. I was like, I want a better headspace to do better in competitions. That was it. And today I think it's a lot more than that. I think it's more about how I want my mind to be, you know, going forward. I don't want to be cluttered with notifications and thoughts. And I don't want to see everyone's lives, you know. It seems a little bit cliche perhaps, but, you know, we weren't meant to see all this stuff, you know, like, you know, 20 years ago, this wasn't here at all. You know, we would have to go talk to people in person if we wanted to hear about their lives. And I think that's just a more high quality way of interacting with people in your life. And it's something I try to stay true to as much as possible. And sure, maybe I don't talk to as many people as other people do. I don't have as many friends or as many relationships. But again, I think we weren't meant to have the huge network of people in our lives as we do today. So I try to stay stay close knit and have just the people I want to really stay in my life, in my life.
I will definitely link that blog post in the description so people can take a look, and the blog in general as well. But yeah, you mentioned that you did, I guess YouTube is kind of social media, and you sort of made an exception for that, even though video making is like way more time consuming.
Sure.
It takes so much effort. I guess, why did you decide to make the exception for YouTube?
Yeah. So of course this crossed my mind too. And it actually wasn't me that started the YouTube channel. It was my husband. And he also wasn't completely sold on it at first. It was, to be honest, it all goes back to my stepdad. He was the one who really pushed us to do to do YouTube. Because again,
it's hard at all.
I know. Yeah. but yeah, in Canadian climbing, again, like we are very poorly funded. So, you know, that goes down to athlete sponsorships as well. Like, it's not just that the national team doesn't pay us, it's that there's not as many people and companies out there that are looking to support Canadian athletes. So the dream of just being a professional athlete and having that fund our entire livelihood is just not a thing in Canada. And there has to be something else. So either we get like a part-time job or we do something online or something like YouTube. And I think YouTube was the best option because we have somewhat, I'd say, interesting lives. You know, we're going to World Cups, we're traveling around, we're training full time for climbing. It's an interesting story. We're married, we're really young. We're both on the national team. We're both bouldering only athletes. Like, it was just a good kind of hook story that I think lended itself very well to YouTube. So my stepdad convinced my husband to start YouTube. And at first, his plan was to record every single training session he does, like just film it all, and then kind of voice it over, kind of like a YouTube, like a video game streaming, kind of like Twitch, but for climbing training. So true to his word, he did exactly that. I think he spent like 2 months preparing for a North American Cup, and he filmed every single training session he did, and he talked about it, and he posted it every single day. We did daily videos back then. And it was crazy, and it was really high quality because he had some really insightful things to say about climbing and very specific kind of beta advice and like very just like climbing tips and knowledge that just really isn't out there on the internet. And I think that really struck a chord with a lot of people. And he got some great feedback from it, and he started kind of developing a bit of community around his journey as a competition climber. And so it reached a certain point where I was like, at first I didn't really want to do it because of the social media element. I was like, I don't want to see the comments. I don't want to have to think about filming myself. Like, I just want to focus on training. But then it got to a point where I was like, okay, like I watched him do this for 6 months now, and it doesn't look that invasive. And the comments, you don't know who's making them. You're not watching other people on YouTube. You're just watching YouTube. Like, you know, the experience on YouTube, it's not, you're not seeing your friends everywhere, because not your friends don't have YouTube channels generally. You're seeing kind of strangers, or you're watching tutorial videos and all that sort of stuff. So I realized that I didn't think it would actually be that harmful. And to like true to my word, like it really isn't. It's a lot more detached than you think it is. Sure, you're checking comments and maybe you're stressing a little bit over how many views a video is going to get or something like that. But it never goes down to like your core like self-worth. It doesn't go down to like, I posted like a picture and it only got 5 likes or 10 likes. Do people not like me? Like, it's very personal, I find, on social media, like Instagram or whatever. But on YouTube, you know, you put out a video and it's like, it's actually about the video. It's not about you. It's about how good was your video and what was your content like? So for that reason, I really took to YouTube. At first, I was trying to maybe copy what he was doing. But then over time, I tried to kind of developed my own little niche within our channel. And now I do more educational style, kind of beginner, intermediate focused, just purely climbing tips and technique kind of stuff. And I think that does really well on our channel. And my whole philosophy with the channel is that it isn't about me. So I don't introduce myself typically in my videos. I just get straight to the content. There was one video that did really well. It was just me going through almost every footwork kind of technique I could think of. So I took a notebook because I like being analog. So I took a notebook and I just wrote down every single footwork thing I could think of. So like switching feet, stemming, all that sort of stuff. And then I made a video about it and I didn't introduce myself. It was just like within 10 seconds, we're already talking about footwork and it did really well. And I was able to stay really far away from it. The comments were about the content, not me. Whereas Zach has a bit more personality in his, cause he's talking about his day. He's talking about how he feels on the wall. And so comments are very like, you know, great job, Zach, like you can do it, all that sort of stuff. Or like asking him questions about his life. The questions on mine are about the content and I love it. We're at the point now where it does feel like a job, like kind of a side thing. And it's great because we're starting to get income from it and we're starting to fuel our pro climbing adventures. You know, it's not what I thought of when I thought of being a professional climber. I thought I would be just climbing and I didn't have to worry about anything else. But, you know, the realities of just life say that, you know, that's just not how it works. So I'm actually really happy on YouTube. And I think this is something that I'll be able to sustain. Like we will be able to sustain like, as soon as we're done competing, when our career is over, we just have this like waiting for us. It's been a really awesome journey. And I would definitely recommend YouTube, like creating on YouTube to everyone. Like I think it's just a great way to give out more high quality, just like down to earth, better content, I find.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective on it. Because I feel like you hear a lot of YouTubers talk about how emotionally invested they get in the numbers and the comments and stuff like that. And I definitely wouldn't say that I'm not invested in that way. So it's interesting to hear that it doesn't really affect you.
Well, I'll say it used to affect me for sure. Like when I didn't really know how YouTube worked, because it is a learning curve. Like it's not just about making videos. It's about optimizing the first 10 seconds and the thumbnail and all this sort of stuff. Like it's definitely a different ball game. And yeah, at first when I didn't know what I was doing, I thought I was putting out genius content like 24/7. And then when it only had whatever amount of views, I was like very destroyed. But then it only took me a few months to realize that it's almost like competing. You know, you go to a comp and you don't do well. And you don't just take that as like, I tried my best and that's just it. And like, no, you just go back to the gym and you try and train and you figure out a different approach. So that's exactly what I did with YouTube. I would just take a badly performing video and just say, okay, what didn't work? What do I need to learn? What is the next step? What's the next video?
Okay. So getting into your personal life a little bit, you mentioned that you got married super young. And I think some people in the Discord are also familiar with that. One person said that it still feels illegal for anyone born after the year 2000 to be married, which I totally agree with. I mean, I'm not that old. I'm not surrounded by many people who are married. And I was born before 2000. So, tell me about how your relationship started and I guess why you decided to get married young.
Right. Yeah. So Zach was always on the national team. Like, you know, you're a youth climber, you make the national team for the first year, and then you've got all your little youth national teammates. And he was one of them. And he was a little bit more, I'd say, like standoffish than most people on the youth team. He didn't really like just being around people. He was pretty competitive at the time. He didn't like lead. He was always boulder only, like from the start, which I found interesting. But we didn't really talk for many, many years until there was a Pan American Championship in 2018. So this is now 3 or 4 years after we had met for the first time. And that was when we first actually talked to each other, because there were only four athletes sent to that event. Like, only four people wanted to go to Ecuador for that event. And he and I were two of them. So right when we first spoke and we first had a conversation, I was like, okay, he's really like nice. He's just a nice person. Like, this is great. But then it took us another, 4 years to actually like become friends. Like I said, like, it's hard on the national team to be friends with each other, because we're all competitive. We're all living all over the place, and it just doesn't happen naturally. And so there was a flight. So Zach and I think we were really alike, because we were the ones that went to the events that no one else went to. So we went to the Ecuador event. We would always kind of see each other at events, but we never happened to talk. And then there was an event in Albuquerque, New Mexico, in 2021. And we both were two of the only Canadians to go to that event again. And I saw him at the airport, and I noticed he was like really early for his flight. Like, it was like 6 a.m. I had to get up at like 4 a.m. for my flight. And I got to the airport and I see him there, and he's like already at the gate. I'm like, okay, that's kind of weird. And then I got on my flight and I realized he's not getting on the flight. He's just sitting there still. And his flight was actually an hour later than mine. So he got there earlier to get to a later flight. And it was just like, he probably had to get up at like 3 a.m. to like go to this flight. And I thought it was crazy. But then I happened to see him at my connecting flight. We both connected in Denver. And so I saw him sitting like there, and I went over and I basically just confronted him and said, why were you so early to that flight? That was ridiculous. And how did you end up here? Your flight was like later than mine. And that was the day I think we became friends. I don't know why. Like, it was just, I just have a problem. Like, I like to be like exactly on time or like late for things. Oh, he's like an hour early kind of person. His mom was in the military, so he's like born to be like really rigid about timing. And I just was not. So I found that really fascinating, to be honest. And so we became friends. I think it, like, we were friends for like a year that time, and we would actually train together. Like, I thought it was the coolest thing to like train with someone on the national team. Like, I hadn't even climbed with any like female national team athletes. He was like basically the first like national team person I climbed with. So I thought it was the coolest thing. And then he was super fun and nice. And then it just turned into a relationship. And I think when we went to World Cups together, and we, you know, traveled Europe together, and it was just like the craziest, like almost like fairy tale kind of thing. Like, it seemed like the perfect relationship. I was like, it can't get any better than this. Like, he's perfect basically. And I was like, if that's really true, then like, seems like marriage is like the next step. Right. So there was a day where we were just like lounging around, sitting on the couch or whatever. And I turned to him, I was like, do you think we should get married? And he's like, yeah, sure, why not? Oh, and God. That was basically it. It just seemed like too perfect to ignore. And if we really were like, it literally can't get any better than this, we're like, okay, this is it then. And might as well tie a knot on it, I guess.
So was that like the proposal? Or?
It was actually, yeah. Wow. We had planned to move to Germany actually a month later, just like as boyfriend, girlfriend. And so a couple weeks before we were supposed to fly out, we had the proposal conversation, I guess. And we decided to delay our flight by a couple weeks in order to get married right before we left, because we could either get married before or after. There was no getting married abroad, because that was just too we looked into it and we're like, that's way too complicated. So we were engaged, quote unquote, for 2 weeks, and then we got married, and then we've been married ever since.
Wow, that's a more wild story than I was expecting, even.
Yeah. Trust me, our family definitely thought it was a bit wild as well. Like, I was 21 and he was 22 at the time. And, you know, we're born after 2000 and we're from Ontario. And now that we've moved to Montreal, it's even weirder, because people from Montreal are very, I'd say, hipster is the vibe I'm starting to get here. And so very, very uncommon. And so people actually assume we're siblings before we are married, because I took his last name. So, we're the Richardsons, but like, it's very unclear if you don't like really pay attention as to whether we're siblings or not. And on YouTube,
it looks very similar. So
I know, like, it could be step siblings, it could be, you know, different parent, whatever. I was like, okay, a charitable, yes, I guess there could be a situation. But it was starting to be a little bit weird on YouTube because like the whole premise was that we're married pro climbers. So it was kind of, we didn't want to be known as siblings. So there was actually a couple of weeks ago, we decided to make a video called Married Pro Climbers versus Block Shop. And we just did like a vlog saying, hey, we just got to clear the air here. We're married, actually, not siblings. And so many comments said, like from long-term subscribers saying, I totally thought you guys were siblings. And we were just like, that's really weird.
Interesting. I don't think I ever got that. Because I saw your guys' YouTube channel like close to when it first started, I think. I was just very involved in the climbing YouTube scene. Mm-hmm. I don't think I ever got the idea that you guys were siblings. I'm not sure where people got that.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
No, I was super confused too, because we were living together. We're like, okay, we're going to move to Montreal now. We're going to move to Frankfurt now. He's talking about me in his videos and our profile picture is together. And we're talking as like, it's just like, we either are like the super, like very, very close family, like to the point where we move across the world with each other, or we're married. And I guess it was just like the weirdness of being this young and married and taking the last name too is just like, definitely not known these days. So I guess like charitably, I think that's where they were coming from. Personally, I'm like you. I thought it was very obvious that we were married.
Yeah. I mean, I swear it was like in a bio or something, but I guess not everyone reads that.
I was going to say, yeah, we definitely like, we say it places. We say it all over the place, but apparently it's not known enough. So we're clearing the air once again.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So something I've always been kind of curious about is relationships between climbers in the circuit. People always say like, oh, don't shit where you eat. So what's your take on relationships within the climbing community and the World Cup circuit?
And you mean like friendships or actual relationships?
I meant like actual relationships, but friendships are actual relationships.
Right.
But I mean, yeah, also friendships, because I'm sure that gets hard as well with like competitiveness.
Yeah. I mean, so Zach actually, when we first started dating, he was on the national team and he was going to World Cups. But then there was a year where they took the quota down from 5 per country to 2. And that's 2 kind of with an asterisk. I guess if you have a number of athletes in like the top 10 or top 40, you get extra quota for the country. At the time, though, we didn't have any men in the top 40. So it was just 2 to each country. And he was essentially kind of like kicked off the team. I think he was like ranked 3rd or 4th, like something just under the quota. And because people just want it, like people, like Canadians always say yes to World Cups. Like we always fill up our quota typically. He just didn't have an opportunity for a year and a bit. So it was actually a little bit tough when I was going to World Cups and he wasn't, because it was the first time in his career that he'd not been selected to a World Cup. And if it were in reverse and I was not going to World Cups and he was, I can tell you I would be upset. You know, I wouldn't want to go. I wouldn't really want to go with him. I'd probably go and watch him or whatever and cheer him on just to be supportive. But in the back of my mind, I'm like dreading being there. I don't want to be there. But I, you'd have to ask him, but I'm fairly certain he is just such a good guy that he's just supportive, like straight up. But yeah, it can be tricky when there are some World Cups that are really far away, like China, where it's just like not feasible at all to come with me and I have to just go by myself. And it's tough to just be kind of doing the long distance for even just like a couple weeks. It's just kind of tough when you're doing something so intense, like a World Cup, where you really kind of need that like family support. And, you know, the team is great. I've got lots of friends on the national team, the Canadian team, but we don't see each other very often. So it does feel a little bit lonely being on the World Cup circuit without a coach, with just a few teammates. And then because he wasn't on the national team, there was a point where he had to do qualifying events in the States, which are North American Cups that qualify you for the national team in Canada. And then I was doing World Cups at the same time. So last year, we didn't see each other for a whole month. And I did 2 World Cups in that time, and he did a couple events. And it was pretty crazy and not very enjoyable. So just even a month of not seeing him was pretty bad. But I know that, you know, if you're in a relationship with someone that is on a different national team than you, it's probably even worse. And I commend those people for going through that, but I don't wish it on myself. Like, it sounds like just difficult. It just sounds difficult. But, you know, if there is someone that's just like really, like you really stick it out for this person, then definitely go for it. But yeah, no, not my cup of tea for sure.
Were you ever concerned about like, oh, if we broke up, we'll see each other at the national team and like competitions?
Well, yeah, you know, breaking up really has never crossed my mind. You know, like we got married immediately because I was like, this is definitely it. So yeah, I wish I, like, that isn't, I've actually never thought about that before.
Well, okay, that's awesome.
Yeah, I like to think that I would just be, I'm always just so focused on the climbing that I'm sure it would be fine. But yeah, no, this is the first time totally considering that. So it doesn't sound very nice,
though. Think about it. You don't need to think about it. Okay. Have you ever like felt competitive against Zach? I mean, you said you're a very competitive person, so.
Yeah, no, absolutely. He's won nationals twice. And so that's just like, all, like, that's like, for me, that's like enough said. Like, it's like, man, I've done a lot on the World Cup circuit, but I haven't done what I really want to do, which is win nationals. And he's done it twice, and he did it last year. And last year I actually came in third, which was a little bit harder. Like, I typically come in second, to be honest. And then I came in third even, and it's like, okay, I'm getting further away from this. And he came in first that year. And it was like really, like we're really, it's also added pressure because we're trying to do like a double win. Like, we've never double won something. And so we're like, okay, we're going to nationals. We're both in finals. We've both got really good odds. This is it. And then he wins and I don't win. And then it's just like, that was really rough. I'd say it probably added to the, like the sting of that competition a little bit that he did win it. But at the same time, you know, he's in the men's side. So it's like, it's not, we're not directly competing against each other ever. So it's not that bad. That said, though, I do train with him from time to time, and he is a lot stronger than me. And not even just stronger, but just like, he's just really good at rock climbing. And sure, I'm better at him than a few things. Like, I'm probably a little better at slab. There's a couple technical things like here and there. But as a whole, it's hard to train with him because he is quite a bit better than me, probably like a grade or two higher. So I am constantly chasing him, and I'm constantly comparing myself against him when I really shouldn't be. And I should kind of like just take it as like this really good climber I have the opportunity to climb with and just learn from him and watch him and just be all that. But I'm still working on letting go of that a little bit. And it's difficult. It's because we are just so, we're doing the same thing. We're going for the same goals. And we're both trying to be really good at competition climbing. And he's just a little bit better at the thing I'm really trying hard to be really good at. And yeah, so it's, I'm getting better, I'd say. Like, a year ago was probably way worse than it is today, but it's nowhere near how I want it to be. Like, I'd love to just walk into the gym and have like absolutely no ego when it comes to climbing with him. But yeah, he's just sending way too many boulders. Like, it's like, I can't keep up with it.
I mean, at least with general climbing, you can just justify it as like, oh, he's a lot stronger. So it's a bit different between like men and women. But yeah, how do you manage those feelings like when, like what happened at nationals?
It's honestly, nationals was the first time the first most recent competition that really hit me poorly. I'm typically pretty level-headed when it comes to competition results. But like I said, nationals is just really, it's about, like, it's not even about qualifying for the national team anymore. These days with national team qualifications for Canada, you actually can qualify via World Cups or North American Cups, and those are worth a little bit more points than a national would be. So there's actually nothing really on the line when it comes to nationals except for the glory, I'd say. So for me to enter nationals, you know, I'm looking to win it, and to not win it is like, just, I, what did I even do? Like, I didn't get any points. I did nothing. I just wasted a bunch of skin is basically what happened. So yeah, when Zach's winning it, sure, I'm happy for him. For sure. Like I really want to see him succeed. At the time, he hadn't even qualified. He hadn't been qualified for World Cups for a while. So I'm definitely rooting for him to go to World Cups. That's absolutely, I would never want him to not make the team. That's terrible. But yeah, nationals, honestly, is just a different story than everything. Like, I feel like I'm super supportive And it's not like I'm not supportive of Nationals. It's just like, it's Nationals is like, it's like about me, I guess. Like, it's just like, I'm really concerned about myself when it comes to Nationals, because I'm really trying to prove something to myself. And the kind of stuff that's going on around me, like Zach's performance at Nationals, is just like, it doesn't really factor in as much. And it's hard for me to see him achieve what I've always wanted to achieve. But then at the same time, he's kind of seeing me achieve what he wants to achieve. So it's like, he seems to be dealing with it well, whereas I'm like just really focused on like one specific placement at one comp, and it's like super stressful. So Nationals aside, I'd say I'm very supportive of his career, and his successes are my successes. And I think we both know what we're like, we both know how much we're putting into this kind of the training and all that. But Nationals is just, is a whole nother thing.
Well, geez, 7 years. It is hard to deal with.
It's too much. It's too many. Oh my God.
Yeah. I mean, I love Atlanta too, so it's hard, but yeah, it would be great to see you break that streak. It sounds like it surely weighs on you.
Yeah. It's funny though. Like, it seems like people don't actually know, like, I obviously know my placements at all the past seven Nationals, but who else is actually like knows the stats and knows exactly how many Nationals I've lost, right? Like, I was talking to a setter at Beta Block the other day, and actually, no, he was talking to someone else, and then that girl told me what they were talking about. And he said, oh yeah, it's so nice that Maddie shows up to Nationals every year, and like, and she's always winning. And then my friend, because she knows my, you know, I've been like venting about Nationals for however long, she was like, oh, well, like, you know, Maddie's never actually won. He actually didn't know that. He actually like didn't assume that. And I think that conversation really, I think about it from time to time. She told me about this like a month ago or maybe 2 months ago. And I think about it a lot because it makes me feel a lot better, because it's like, I do feel like I'm almost like failing publicly. Like, I'm losing Nationals in front of everyone, in front of the country. When in fact, you know, making the podium is not a bad result. Like, that is very hard to achieve in and of itself. And I think I really need to step back and realize, okay, I'm on the podium every year. Like, come on, like, this is not, I'm not failing at Nationals every year. And it does still look like success, because that is success. Like, there's a reason first, second, and third are all up on a little podium. You know, it's like, it's, these are all great results.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say, like, it's not really losing to get on the podium. Like, I'm pretty sure absolutely. Anything on the podium is a win.
Yeah. So yeah, it's definitely better. But he only said this, I wish he said this to me like 4 years ago, you know, and then I could really take the stress off of it and realize that I'm doing great and I just need to like keep doing me. But yeah, it's interesting for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely get like the competitive vibe. Does Atlanta know that you kind of have this like mortal enemy type deal going on?
You know, she definitely does. Okay. Yeah. So we never really spoke like friend to friend, like personal kind of her entire career. I was always looking up to her, and then one day I started performing well in World Cups, and then all of a sudden it was like kind of a peer-to-peer relationship that my, at least from my perspective, it kind of turned into. And just the whole while we just never really connected, and I think it's because like I am very competitive, so I was never looking to like make friends, I guess. And it was always about just like, you know, she's someone to look up to and to like strive to be. And you know, I always had the most respect for her. And I never, you know, I don't think she ever knew that, maybe, or maybe I never said it. And maybe it didn't come across in just the way I present myself. You know, I don't smile when I compete. You know, I'm like very focused. And that's just how I am. I wish I was one of the people like Atlanta that just like smiles all the time and is like super psyched to send a boulder. But in my mind, you know, sending one boulder doesn't mean you win. So I'm like, I'm not gonna celebrate yet, you know? But recently, actually, she spent some time in Montreal. Like, I randomly showed up to the gym to climb with Babette, one of the other national team members, and she was just there. And we ended up spending we climbed together that day and then the next day. And this was the first time we'd ever climbed together. And this was right before her final IFSC event, which was a little bit unfortunate. Like, I wish this kind of happened maybe 3 years ago. But we finally, I think we talked a little bit more, and I feel a lot better about our relationship. And I think the problem was definitely just communication. Like, we just never really clicked, and we never tried to be friends or, you know, just be anything close to just like chummy. We were just kind of on the same team, and she does her thing and she has her friends and I've got mine. But we finally connected and it was really nice. And I told her, like, I remember I hugged her goodbye because I probably wouldn't see her for a while because she was about to retire. And I was like, I wish we did this 3 years ago, but I'm glad we had the chance to like hang out finally. And she was like coaching me through a boulder and like it was all good. But yeah, it was pretty tense for a few years there. And there was nothing, there was never like a, we never said anything to each other or did anything like mean. It was just kind of like a vibe. And so I'm really happy with the way we left it off, at least.
Awesome. Well, that's really great to hear. yeah, so I think that is a good place to end those. We can get into a couple of the Discord questions, and then I think that'll be a good place to end it. So the first Discord question, what do you think about the current field of Canadian comp climbing women compared to other nations that you could train with?
Yeah, I mean, I don't like, we're super strong. We are strong. I love compete, like I love climbing with the Canadian women. They really push me. And it might not look like they are neck and neck with me if you look at World Cup results, but they absolutely are. And I think World Cups are just very difficult. And I think mentally above all else, they are just mentally like hard to compete at your absolute best at. And I think that's the main separator between me and the Canadian female team is like, I just have learned how to be confident and calm at World Cups. And it is, I almost found it by accident and I can't really explain why and why I feel like more at ease at World Cups, but I feel like I'm able to perform like at my peak at these events and they don't quite have that mindset. But the field, I think we've got a great team that we have going to World Cups. And it's just a matter of like, when they're able to like prove to themselves that they can compete and do as well as I am doing. And not to say that I'm like a perfect World Cup climber, but we definitely are all very, very good at climbing. And it's honestly, it's part of the reason I haven't won nationals. Like it is actually a difficult field. And I guess other national teams, it's hard to say. I think it, like from the outside, Team Germany, for example, looks like they've got a really great group of girls that are just crushing it. And same with, you know, Japan, like most countries, it looks like they've got a couple people. In Canada, it's typically always been just like one outlier will like make it through. Like we've had Sean was the outlier in the men's, and then we had Alana for a few years. And then now we've got Oscar doing really well on the men's side. And then we've got me doing. So it's like it doesn't look like we've got like a good, strong, like base of teams behind us. But I think we really do. And it's just a matter of like us not training together. I think if we all train together more and they saw like their level is like the same as my level, I think that would give a lot of confidence. And I think other national teams probably have that every day. They see each other. And then they see one person going and doing whatever at the World Cup. And they're like, okay, I just was doing way better at her in that training session. Of course I can go to the World Cup and do the same as she's doing. I would assume that's part of the mindset at least.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. I think like competition just breeds greatness in general. That also kind of touches on like the next Discord question. So let me know if you have like more to expand on. This one says, in your latest video, I think this was maybe like a couple weeks ago, though. Zach mentions that you mostly climb alone. Would there be a benefit to making Team Canada a bit more of an institution with dedicated team training programs and infrastructures?
Yeah, I mean, that would be the dream with a little bit of funding for sure. We did actually establish a national training center in the Richmond Oval in Vancouver a couple years ago. But we kind of just said that it was a national training center and then we didn't really do anything about it. I think everyone on the national team probably has like entrance to that gym, but it's not really a good bouldering gym, I'd say. It's a great lead gym. It's probably the best lead gym in the country, but the bouldering is not really where it needs to be. So yeah, that would be nice, but we are such a big country. So you'd have to move. We would have to move to that location And without funding, you know, it's just really hard to justify something like that, to like uproot your life to just go be with other national team athletes when, you know, down to its core, we don't even have like a really good national program. Like, we don't have training camps. We don't have a coach. Like, it's like a lot of stars need to align for this to happen. But I think it is the absolute next best step for Canada in terms of like upping the level of our national team. I think, you know, funding aside, you know, organization aside, like when we are talking about like, how do we improve the national team? I think that's absolutely what needs to happen. And we're almost starting to do it organically in Montreal. We're missing a few Ontario people and a couple BC people, but for the most part, we've got a good chunk of the national team here in Montreal. So it would be great, like very cost effective if we just kind of, if CEC just said, all right, Montreal is it, you know, try to be here as much as possible. And, you know, if in the future we're like, okay, we can give you housing when you're here, that would be amazing. And with the array of climbing gyms and just climbing together all the time, I think the confidence will go up for the whole team. And it would just be like amazing. I think we'd see huge results on the World Cup circuit, but it seems like we're a few years away from that for sure.
Yeah, it seems like getting all the climbers together would probably help a whole bunch. I know, like, for me at least, when I'm climbing with people who climb harder than me or, like, just as hard as me, it fuels me a lot more than if I'm just by myself or if I'm already, like, doing the best. Because I'm just like, I don't know, maybe I have no, like, internal motivation. But, okay, cool. I think that's all the questions I had. Is there any, like, last words that you want to get out there?
Like, drama aside and, like, funding aside, I love being in Canada. You know, I like representing Canada. I don't want you to think that, like, I hate the CEC or whatever else, or I don't like Atlanta. Like, I enjoy everything. I love that Montreal's got a great scene. I'm only here to kind of prop up Canada and like push us to get even further. And I think, you know, I think just leading by example and just being more involved in the community and like really getting the athletes together and like proving that we are all really a solid country for climbing and we can really push this and achieve our dreams. I think that's the way to look at it.
Awesome. And that's a great statement to end on. So yeah, thank you so much for joining me. Anything you want to shout out or let people know where they can find you if they have more questions?
Yeah. So our YouTube channel is just Richardson's Climbing. Our website is also Richardson's Climbing. And my husband's Instagram account is Richardson's Climbing. So you can just check out any of those things.
Yeah, I'll link those all in the description. Cool. Thank you so much for joining me. And it was amazing to talk to you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much for making it to the end of the podcast. Don't forget to like and subscribe if you enjoyed. Otherwise, you are a super fake climber. If you're listening on a podcasting platform, I'd appreciate if you rate it 5 stars. And you can continue the discussion on the free competition climbing Discord linked in the description. Thanks again for listening. We'll be right back.